Insights, solutions, and networking all come together at RSA Conference. Join a global cybersecurity community at rsaconference.com/ITSPMAG24.
Welcome to the ITSP Magazine Podcast Network. You're listening to a new Redefining Cybersecurity podcast with Sean Martin. Have you ever thought that we're selling cybersecurity insincerely, buying it indiscriminately, and deploying it ineffectively? Well, perhaps we are. Let's look at how we can organize a successful information security program that integrates business culture with people, process, and technology to drive growth and protect business value. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Imperva is the cybersecurity leader whose mission is to protect data and all paths to it with a suite of integrated application and data security solutions. Learn more at imperva.com. Devo unlocks the full value of machine data for the world's most instrumented enterprises. The Devo Data Analytics Platform addresses the explosion in volume of machine data and the crushing demands of algorithms and automation. Learn more at devo.com.
Hello, everybody. You're very welcome to a new episode of Redefining Cybersecurity here on the ITSP Magazine Podcast Network. This is Sean Martin, your host, where I get to talk to all kinds of cool people who are many times smarter than myself, thankfully, and do a lot of research and have a lot of insights into things that help us run our businesses more securely so we can not just protect the revenue that we generate, but to actually help the business grow and reach their growth objectives. And bottom line is one thing, and if you're spending money paying ransomware, you're not helping the bottom line, even if you do help things grow. And that's what we're going to be talking about today, is the state of ransomware and kind of the culture around that, and maybe some trends that we're seeing that might change how we view and address and respond to ransomware attacks. And I'm thrilled to have Ari Schwartz on. Ari, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Sean.
And this was, as many of my conversations seem to be these days, is driven by a post that you made, which was a result of an article or blog that you wrote titled "The Path to Banning Ransomware Payments." I thought, this is an interesting topic. Let's see if Ari is willing to join me for a chat, and you agreed. So thanks for joining me for this. I'm excited to get into the nuts and bolts of it. Before we do, a few words from you, kind of a view of your background, some of the things you've been involved with, and we'll go from there.
Sure. So I started working on tech policy probably around, about almost 30 years ago, and then came to Washington a couple of years after working in Boston for a while with a bunch of nonprofits. And then my first work that I did led to some work on privacy and security, worked at the Center for Democracy and Technology for 12 years, and then moved into government and worked at NIST for several years. And then from there was detailed to the secretary's office to be the tech advisor to the secretary, and then moved to the White House and National Security Council staff, and was there for 2.5 years. When I left there, I was contacted by an old friend of mine who was at a firm called Venable, which is a law firm, asked me to build a consulting team there, of non-lawyers. So we're a bunch of non-lawyers at a law firm that we do policy and we do some operational work as well. And, really pulling together lots of other companies and trying to come up with solutions in this space is part of what we do, as well as working with the clients of the firm and individual companies on their policies or processes. And so we... you know, one of the groups that we worked with is the Institute for Security and Technology. They built this ransomware task force in 2020. It started around then, and we were active in that from the beginning. And one of the issues that came up there was ransomware payments. We had obviously working with a bunch of clients in this space already knew a good deal about ransomware, at least how the payment side work and how people negotiated it and how to work with insurance companies on it. Almost everyone in that at that point, I mean, that was like, you know, as things were changing, almost everyone at that point was paying ransoms. And there was a viewpoint, from I think most of the people in the task force, like, we're not at the point where if you ban payment today, like, that would be a disaster for everybody. And I was certainly of that camp. But I did suggest that, you know, it should be the goal of governments to get to the point where we could ban ransomware, right? Like payments of ransomware and ban ransom, you know, so that people wouldn't be paying. And that should really be the goal. And really, we have to build a path there. And the first steps of that are what the ransomware, the original version of the ransomware task force focused on, with some point saying basically at some point governments are going to have to ban it. So one of the things, and I found this year that really we had gotten to a point where a lot less people are paying. You know, in fact, if you read some of the reports, it suggests it's under 50%. I would say it's probably right around 50% from what I've seen in the field. You know, a lot of those payments now are more about extortion than about locking down computers. But instead of, you know, we have this information on you and we're going to send it out is what more of those payments are about. So the it has changed with the types of payments we're seeing. And I think we're at a point now where we can kind of have a conversation of what it might look like. And that's really, and a lot of in November, December, I was contacted several times by people talking about, maybe we should ban ransomware now. And I think I wanted to kind of lay out in this paper a little bit more of how we get there. Having thought about it for the last 3 years, you know, knowing that we're going to need this path eventually.
Yeah, absolutely. And I had the pleasure of speaking with Sean Tuma the other day, who's also at a law firm looking at this operationally speaking. Now, he and I were talking more around broader risk management and security operations and incident response and the connection to cyber insurance. And he confirmed your point and also a stat that's in the article or the blog that you wrote that less entities are paying. We didn't talk about the amounts, but the amounts seem to be going up, even though people are paying. Yeah. So it was interesting that those things jive. What I want to do is maybe kind of talk through why maybe what Sean suggested is that organizations are better prepared, right? So they have the backups to recover. They have some technologies and controls in place to mitigate the likelihood of compromise. I'd like to get your perspective. Why fewer are paying? Are they more prepared? And then what about the other half?
I think they are more prepared. I think if people are more prepared. I think there has been a new focus from government and from private sector on combating ransomware. So there's a lot more information being shared about the threat actors and about their techniques, a lot more tools being built to stop the specific techniques that we saw in the past. So that's why you see a shift in the way that what the actors are doing, that we've seen some lot less reputable people or people who the bad guys are basically not honoring, not coming back, or so if you pay them, they can just come right back, right? And so we've seen some of that. We've seen cases where the keys don't work when you get them, even though you've paid for them, which may or may not be the fault of the bad guy. I mean, they might think they're giving you a key that works, but because of the changes that they've made in the technology over time, it doesn't work. So, I think we've seen some of that, and that kind of it plays into the decision making as well. But I do think there is better prepare. better preparation, there's better backups, there's better segmentation, which plays into it too, where we see sometimes cases where customers say, well, I'll only be losing all my old mail. I don't really care that much, right? I'm not going to pay that much money and run the risks of that for just that, just my, you know, archive mail. So if you have segmentation, you get a little bit better results out of that. But backups obviously are key there too. And that's what Covert says in their report about this, is that the backups play a key role. And I think that's true too. So, so I think that those are the main reasons, but you know, again, people are still paying. So it's not as though it's 100% there, but it's gotten much better.
So I think those two points, there's the economic, which kind of touched on, and there's the, I don't think we really said it directly, but the moral, and I'm looking at your imperatives that you wrote about. Economic is a driver. People might just say, I have the backups and I'm not going to pay, or even if I don't recover, I'm just going to figure a different way out. Then there's the middle one of the national security imperative, which I don't know how many people care about that. Clearly, there's still
the imperatives are more why government, because I think that from the private sector point of view, it's kind of like, well, we'll just work this out over time. Over time, it'll just drift down slowly. Let us continue to pay. We've basically got it. We're moving in the right direction. It might take a while. We might never actually get to zero, but we can keep it at a low level. And I'm trying to say with this argument, like that governments are always going to feel the need to want to ban the payments. And there's three reasons for that. So the first one that I have listed is the moral imperative, right? And that idea is, you know, as you pay, you're actually funding other people. You're funding victims of the crime. Right, you're paying the bad guys to increase the crime, and so it is better for society to stop it in that way. And so, if you think of what governments are there for, that's like just a basic tenet of what governments exist for, is to stop situations where we have that kind of moral imperative together. Like, and this is like goes back to Immanuel Kant, right? So I got to use some things you learn in undergrad, right? Like
there you go.
Talk about the Kantian moral imperative, right? This is just a classic case of that, right? Where when the rational act in a situation is to do the thing that's wrong for society, and everyone has to do that, it's government's job to come in and step in and make sure that it is not the wrong thing to do, that the rational thing to do is the right thing for society, right? So is the way to put that. That's where we see that, some people might make that determination on their own that they shouldn't do it, but for the most case, that's not going to be their driver. They're going to make the rational decision, which in 2020 always was to pay. Now there's a little bit more of a choice in the situation. But that moral imperative still exists in a lot of cases. Then there's the national security imperatives from a government's point of view. And so, and this is why governments didn't care, right? A lot of governments didn't care until 2021 or so, when they started to see that this was funding government actions in particular. And so particularly we saw, there was discussion about this with North Korea, that North Korea, North Korean actors were involved and looking to make money off of ransomware. But we've also seen it from some of the actors that work with Russia. Even if the Russian government isn't actively using it to fund the Russian government, they might be using it. The actors that spend most of their time in ransomware can come over and help the Russian government with something else on the side, or the Chinese or the Iranians. We've seen flirt with it. So I think it is something that has come up quite a bit, and that got governments a lot more interested, and it gets national security side of the house more active on the issue. And they're always looking, you know, if we can come in with a law to solve the situation, they're going to be in favor of that. And then the economic one, which I think is the more straightforward one for most people, which is just a total drain on the society. It's all black market, no upside for most legitimate economy. So all three of those things, I think, play into the way a government thinks about it. Now, from, again, the rational thing to do in 2020 was to pay, right? Even despite all those things, right? And that's really, I think, the driver that where the tension comes in is, you know, people are thinking about this from a rational perspective, totally rational perspective. I mean that from a philosophical sense of the word, not the crazy, not crazy sense of the way it's generally used in society, right? So, but the rational act is was to pay. And now we're getting to the point where that may or may not be the case. And then the question is, how do we tip it a little bit more so that it's not the rational thing to do anymore, so that more people start doing it? And then we can get that number down with some government action involved faster than it would just on its own.
Yep. And let's talk through, there are 4 points there that you suggest lead us to a place where it becomes rational, right? We reach a point where the right and expected and comfortable, we'll say, thing to do is to not pay. And the government gets involved to help with that.
So, ransomware bans, right? They think, well, you're going to go to jail if you pay the fine, right? And I think, and some people have suggested that directly, like, yeah, if you pay a fine, if you pay, or you pay the ransomware, you should go straight to jail for paying the ransomware. That would solve the problem. We made it a criminal act. I don't like the idea of criminalizing the way a victim has to respond, and even for the government to kind of make that determination, especially when it has been the rational thing to do for until now, right?
Another choice, except the one that now is unlawful, and one can be penalized for it. That's
right.
Both situations are bad. Yeah,
I think if we think of it more of as a civil situation, right, where we can come up with actions where it's a fine or it's a or other things that we people have to do if so that there's other downsides. To their action, then they might weigh it differently, right? And especially we'll start with reporting, which the U.S. government has already decided to move towards for critical infrastructure, at least that people have to report ransomware payments. So we're already moving in that direction. The second one that I have there that I don't think has gotten but has come up in other contexts is to have government security oversight for companies that pay. So if you pay a ransom, that's fine, but then you also enter into a 20-year agreement with the Federal Trade Commission, as they do for binding agreements that they come into with companies that have had big security problems in the past, have a pattern or practice of lack of security, right? So I give the Federal Trade Commission as an example. There could be some other government agency probably, but I like the idea of having it be an independent regulatory body that is the one that's kind of overseeing that effort and, have them make that determination and run that program, especially one that has had success doing that in the past. Then the other one is the one I raised before, where you could give fines, right? You could just add in, some flat amount, or it could be the same amount that you pay the criminal, you have to pay to the federal government, and that's used into the program for helping companies turn around their security and put back into security, et cetera. And then for criminal charges is the last one I have on there. And again, I don't like the idea of victimizing people. What I would say is if you purposely tried to subvert this system, you weren't reporting it, and you were purposely trying to shove this underground, then it becomes a criminal case. So we're trying to get this all above board as much as we can, turn it more into a civil act, et cetera.
Now, I'm going to raise this point. It's not in your list. I believe all four. Let me double check it. All four of those are, victim reports, victim gets oversight, victim pays fines, victim perhaps has criminal charges. I'm going to bring up a point that I've heard, I don't know, probably 15 years ago, at least 15 years ago, that I don't know if you know Jeremiah Grossman, pitched this idea or presented this idea or concept of of security warranties. I think he calls it software warranties, but where the vendor is claiming to provide the protections are liable to some extent for the failure of their systems to protect against what they're supposed to protect against, in this case, ransomware. I'm wondering what your thoughts on that. I know it's not part of what you wrote about. Just any thoughts on how that fits in, perhaps, as a
There's actually an interesting effort right now in the federal government that where they're having contractors that sell software to the U.S. government self-attest that their security is does what they say it does, right, and meets certain security standards based on the NIST SSDF, right? So. And so they're going to self-attest to that. And then that puts them on the hook for being liable just by saying under the Fraud Act of selling it to the government. You've said that this thing does what you say it does. If it doesn't meet those standards, then you get it. To me, that's probably moving us closer in the right direction than something we could do on ransomware payments. Because on the ransomware payment side, I think it's going to be hard to figure out what failed and why it failed, whether it's whose error it was. And right. If we have to do that for each case, we're going to end up with a lot of litigation around that front, right? As opposed to, so I don't think you get quite to the answer that you'd hope you would, even though I understand the desire to move more liability to the vendors themselves. So I think, I would like to see more of a move towards us coming up with this, what the standards should be for software, and having the companies commit to those standards, and then holding them accountable for that separately from what happens to victims on the side of that. So the victims might be able to, have liability standards against the companies as well, but, we're just trying to stop payments, right? That is the point. Why don't you take the? You have a choice. You have a choice to protect yourself better and have levels of resilience. And you have a choice of once you get hit, like do you fight or do you not fight? We're just trying to tip the balance a little more towards the you should fight, right? And then so it's somewhat of a different set of discussions, even though it's a related area. Right.
Yeah. So I have two burning questions. One is in relation to the standards and perhaps audits and certifications and whatnot, which I think might fit into the last point of your article in terms of exceptions. And there's probably more to it than what I'm thinking of there. And then the other is the role of cyber insurance in this equation. Do you have any thoughts there?
On the standard side, you look at the NIST cybersecurity framework and what profile would be for each sector, and then have them work off of that. Like we've seen the FTC promote that idea in the past in these kind of situations. I think that's probably the direction that I would put it toward, but I think we want to leave it open, as time goes on, if these change. So I would leave it open to the FTC to kind of make that determination, but I personally lean towards the idea of continuing down the path that they've already started on and working with the NIST cybersecurity framework, which has generally been embraced for these kind of situations. And then, they actually have a ransomware profile under the NIST cybersecurity framework. So you could just focus on the NIST on the ransomware profile, right, which it works for any industry. On insurance, I did leave that question out. I think that it's still a very good one. The more talking to the insurance company, some of the insurance companies after I published it, I've sort of gone back and forth a little bit about what the role should be. So I think, there is a question as to whether you say, I think one thing we want to be sure of is that insurance doesn't cover everything involved here, that the insurance isn't paying the government in particular, right? So maybe my first thought was we could have you could still get insurance to cover the payment to the bad actor, right? even though it's, we consider it to be illegal in a civil sense, you could still get a coverage to do that if you need it. I think we could also, but I think there's another approach to it too, where you say that the exemption is given in a case-by-case basis, and it's based on loss of life or major economic harm, right? And the government is making a determination about whether you would have loss of life or major economic harm. And then you could say, well, in those cases, companies that might be in those situations could get insurance, but they would have to get the approval of the government in order to get the insurance, which I think would be, you know, that makes that insurance rarely used. But it does give people, you know, in super terrible situations, the ability to get it paid for. So I'm still between those two kind of viewpoints on like, how does insurance fit into this discussion? You don't want to be in the situation we were in 2020, where insurance was actually fueling ransomware growth. I think later on that stopped, and now we don't see that as much, but you don't want to be, I think we do worry about ransom, everything being paid for by being able to be paid for by the insurance company. But the insurance company's made it harder to get paid back recently, and which is another reason people have gone away from paying. So,
yep. Now this wild idea, and I don't know if you have thoughts on it or not, but perhaps the direct payment, where the decision to make the payment by the organization or by the victim might, to your points earlier, it's right now it's the rational thing to do to make the payment to get out of the mess. Perhaps if there's an intermediary that helps make that decision, I don't know if that's a commercial entity. I don't know that I want to suggest that, but perhaps there's a government entity that's the intermediary. At least then they can see what's going on and who the actors are and what the impact might be and help make the decision. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, so there have been these intermediaries that have worked to negotiate the payments, and there's been some concern about those intermediaries. There's been some that have thought to have been too close to the bad actors and like grown too close to them and like worked out deals with them. I haven't seen that from my side. The ones that we work with are very professional and actually definitely help bring down the prices in the ransoms and tell people, you know, give people a lot of comfort about the steps that they're taking, because they see so many of these and they know who the bad actors are. So I actually think they help, but there has been some discussion about sort of certifying those kind of actors, making sure that they're actually working on behalf of the folks involved, which I think is part of this. But I think
I was thinking more from the, if the government, and I'll just say the government, so having a view into all of that. So more than just, more than we made the payment and now we have to report, I'm thinking if they can be involved during the process, during negotiation, or even before payment's made, they can learn a ton perhaps to help drive.
That's true. I think that's a possibility. It would have to be spelled out a little bit more what kind of cases they get involved, because there are a lot of them. And then the question is, if they're forced to respond to all of them, you're ending up with a very large bureaucracy around something that we're hoping to make go away. So, exactly. Like, it's hard. And then the bureaucracies like look for things to do after they exist. You know, you don't want a zombie bureaucracy around there for trying to put them out.
We have to keep our jobs and keep our budget.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that, I like the idea of them responding to the reporting afterwards, using the reporting to do that. But if we really feel that the best way to stop it, and that might be a good approach. So
what are some of the cases where an exception might be made, assuming we get to a banned state?
I think what we saw, you know, we've seen in some of these cases with hospitals, where you've had hospitals that where it seemed like they're making a life or death decision involved. I think, you know, Colonial Pipeline might be an edge case there, where we felt like the economy was at risk, really at risk. On that one, in the past, you would I don't think the government wanted to be involved in making that decision, and they left it all to the company to make that decision. If you're forced the government to get involved, it might actually be a better decision made in reviewing it. So whether they should pay or not. So I would prefer it to be one of the reasons I like the idea of an independent regulator doing it is because I'd like to have a commission vote on it rather than the FBI making that determination. Because what I've seen of the FBI making determinations in these kind of cases is that they don't want to get involved at all. Like their view is, we're here to investigate and solve these crimes, and we're not here to make the determination. Like, you have to make the decision. So they're almost never going to give an exemption for anything. They don't want to be the one who's put on the line and has to make the determination of exactly when that happens. So it has to be in a totally extreme case in that kind of case. So I think in some ways it's more important who the one making the determination is, and they can come up with a set of criteria around it. But I do think it would be a extreme case, like a hospital or there have been cases where we've seen entire towns shut down or state government shut down for long periods of time. So I think that, what's the economic harm to that town and state and to make that determination? It might be worth keeping them down and have them kind of work their way out of it themselves, not pay. I think we've seen governments successfully do that. So I don't want to say in every one of those cases, but I think you want to have that kind of balance review.
Yeah. Yeah, the first thing comes to mind is if it's critical and they get the exception, they become even an even bigger target because right. Then the criminals know, well, those are the only ones that get to pay, so we may as well target them.
You don't want to move it more towards life or death. I do think at that point, when you have had that happen to you, though, they better like buck them up and make sure that they can withstand attacks in the future as well. So big for that reason.
So I have a three-part question to close here, Ari. How likely and when do you think a ban might happen? And what, if any, blockers exist that need to be removed in order for it to happen? I can start with those two if you want, and then I'll have the third.
Yeah. I think that eventually it will happen. I think countries will do it. I mean, we ban a similar situation as we ban payments to terrorists, kidnappings, payments to terrorism, right? And pretty much most countries do that at this point. So I think once you see one country start to do it and come up with a successful approach to it, it's going to, there'll be dominoes. Other countries will pick up on that. So the question is more like, how long will that take? And I'm not totally sure, but I think probably within the next 3 to 5 years, I'll start to see countries come up with approaches on that. And then I think we need a law passed in this case for it to happen, because there's no one that really has the authority to do some of the things that I'm spelling out here. Even if it were that they did take the criminal ban, you would have to add it to the list of things that were already existed in that criminal statute. So I think you probably need legislation and go through Congress in the US for sure.
You see that at the federal level versus a state. I know some of the states have been aggressive for other things.
Yeah, a state could do it. I think it would be sort of weird. Like,
yeah, when
you can pay this in California, but you can't pay it in Oregon, right? Like, so
right.
That would be weird. But it is, and I think people probably would push, for interstate, say that it was unconstitutional because it's interstate commerce involved here. If they're more involved, based in more than one state. So, but I think they could do it. A state could do it. So, but I think generally speaking, a federal would be a lot more successful, especially for the types of things I'm talking about building a program.
Yeah.
Because those programs already exist in the federal level, and most states don't have something like that.
Yeah, makes sense. So a two-way question before I get to three. And you mentioned other countries, and one flips and the other would likely follow. Have you seen actions in other countries on this front that are?
I mean, I've heard folks from the UK talk about it. I think Australia has talked about it. Yeah, those are the two I think that have been the most active I've heard, where I've heard politicians talk about it in those countries. I'm sure there have been some others as well that have raised it, though.
Yeah, makes sense. All right, the third question for my listeners and watchers, what should they prepare for? I mean, obviously better protection, but 3 to 5 years, let's assume this happens, what should they start preparing
for? Yeah, I think one thing is that's obvious is don't assume that your insurance is going to save you on this front. We've seen a lot of people who where insurance isn't paying now as much as they used to, paying out as much as they used to. So even if you've seen cases where insurance has paid in the past, like the rules have changed, and the fact that less people are paying now means insurance is probably going to start paying less, which is, you know, in the larger society sense is a good thing, but for your company, it means you got to do more risk mitigation beyond insurance, right? So, and I think getting a message out to folks that, you know, you need to, like, look for ransomware protection and then also exercise for it. I think, you know, and exercise your backups, right? People forget back up front that, you know, you actually have to make sure that it works.
To restore.
Right? Yeah, you have to be able to restore and not just that it copied over somewhere. So that we've seen a lot of failures on that front too. So I think those are the main sets, but and, you know, segmentation, obviously, as I said before, too, being a big one in this regard too. So I think those are the kind of mitigating factors, and then the just the general set cyber controls out there that they're the same for ransomware as everywhere else. I mean, credential, having good identity management procedures and credentials, credential protection, and segmentation there too is really a key in this one too. So.
Yeah. And I'll toss in, I mean, we all want this to diminish, if not completely go away. So whatever we can do to help do our part to help drive that, I think we should figure out what that is. I don't know what it is. Hopefully somebody else does. But don't fight it, right? Or don't just go with the flow because everybody else is, or it seems the easiest. It might cost a few extra bucks, might take a little extra time. But I think the goal is to get this to go away somehow. So
yeah, I mean, in some ways I think it's been helpful for security companies that have not, I mean, for security entities inside companies that have not been hit to raise it, because almost everyone has been hit by ransomware in some way, or at least some kind of extortion attempt, that it's easy to kind of get it, demonstrate the potential harm from it to your organization. So in that way, I think we should still use it and try and use that to get the attention of leadership around it and get more money to get more resources towards this. So there's almost it's a good way to get capture people's attention.
Yep. Pay me now, pay me later.
Yeah.
It's better, exactly. Better to take care of it ahead of time. Well, Ari, really appreciate the conversation and your time talking to me about this topic and for putting that article together to help drive it. Of course, for folks listening and watching, I'll put links to your LinkedIn post and the blog post as well, so they can all follow up and read that and perhaps connect with you if they have further questions. And any final thoughts, Ari?
No, I appreciate you having me, Sean. Thanks a lot. Good way to kick off the new year here. So
exactly. Let's move toward the band. So thanks everybody for listening and watching. And please subscribe, share with your friends and enemies. And we'll see you on all the future episodes here of Redefining Cybersecurity on ITSP Magazine. Cheers.
Thanks.
Devo unlocks the full value of machine data for the world's most instrumented enterprises. The Devo Data Analytics Platform addresses the explosion in volume of machine data and the crushing demands of algorithms and automation. Learn more at devo.com. Imperva is the cybersecurity leader whose mission is to protect data and all paths to it with a suite of integrated application and data security solutions. Learn more at imperva.com.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Redefining Cybersecurity with Sean Martin, part of the ITSP Magazine podcast network. If you learned something new and this conversation made you think, then share this show and ITSPmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to connect your brand with our conversations, you can sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.
Insights, solutions, and networking all come together at RSA Conference. Join a global cybersecurity community at rsaconference.com/ITSP Mag 24.